the theatrics of Biden and McCarthy, because they're not facing the hard realities. They're kind of dancing around them more to distract us.
And finally, Richard Wolff, if you can talk about the just concluded strike at your own school, at New School University, and Parsons, tell us about it and whether you supported it.
I supported it. If it was more than 100%, I would say more than 100%. Yes, I'm proud. I'm happy that we were part of a strike wave across this country. It's the American working class waking up, realizing what's been done to it for the last 40 years, which includes inflation, rising interest rates, several collapses of our economy, the worst one in 2008 and 9. We've been suffering as the employee majority of the United States, and now there's the beginning of the realization that getting together at the workplace to have a union, to fight, to strike if necessary, these are traditions that the American working class has the right to be proud of in the past, and even more the right to begin to exercise again now. So I'm very happy to be part of that process.
Richard Wolff, I want to thank you for being with us, Professor of Economics Emeritus, University of Massachusetts Amherst, visiting professor at the Graduate Program in International Affairs at the New School University, host of the weekly program Economic Update. And we'll link to your writings and work. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, starting Friday, February 3rd, until Saturday, March 4th. Screenings will take place every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, bringing live interviews with filmmakers, community conversations, and more. Films will be screened at PCC Cascade, Hollywood Theater, and virtually. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org. That's the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, happening throughout the month of February in celebration of Black History Month. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, new Oregon Governor Tina Kotek releases her budget plans. Grants seek to support Oregonians still impacted by the 2020 wildfires, and Tesla is under investigation by the Department of Justice. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 31st, 2023. I'm Althea Billings. New Oregon Governor Tina Kotek releases her 2023 to 2025 budget for the state with ambitious goals. It's the legislative branch that passes the state budget, so Kotek's budget serves as a signal to legislators about what her priorities are. She wants to spend $1 billion to help build and preserve affordable housing. She wants to spend $9 billion on public education in the next 2 years and extra millions to increase staffing at the Oregon State Hospital. Kotek has proposed skipping a normal payment into the state's reserve to help pay for her plan. The reserves currently hold over $2 billion. Portland City office workers are launching an independent union drive. They hope to file for a union election in the next 2 weeks or so. They're the last largest group of Portland City employees that aren't represented by a union. About 870 workers who are administrative specialists, analysts, coordinators would be eligible. It's not the first time that these workers have tried to organize with a union. Twice, workers tried to vote to join AFSCME, but those earlier votes failed. Their website for this union drive say they want a union, shorter regular work weeks, guaranteed raises, schedule flexibility, job security, and fully remote work. Oregonians are still struggling more than 2 years after fires swept through the southern part of the state. Grants from two organizations are helping people recover. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Southern Oregon continues to recover from the fires of 2020, and grants are helping residents in the region. The Alameda Fire in Jackson County devastated the towns of Talent and Phoenix. About 1,700 manufactured homes were destroyed, and more than half of those homes were in communities for people aged 55 and older. Many of those folks are still displaced. AARP Oregon has donated $10,000 to Firebrand Resiliency Collective to help with recovery. Tucker Toich heads the organization and says there are a number of barriers to recovery for older residents.
We experienced this fire on top of COVID and its own supply chain issues, but also the largest building supply price bubble that I think any of us have ever seen. So that income disparity in that community really prevented people from being able to purchase new homes or build new homes.
Toich says disability is another barrier for folks. His organization has also focused on victims' access to technology and their social circles, both of which were struggles for older Oregonians. The Rogue Valley Council of Governments Senior and Disability Services has also provided a $5,000 grant to Firebrand Resiliency Collective. Constance Wilkerson with the organization says it's going to take a long time to rebuild, but efforts are underway in Talent and Phoenix.
It's really heartening to see businesses are being rebuilt and opening. Gardens are being planted around the new homes that are springing up, and lots of homes are under construction.
Wilkerson says, like Firebrand Resiliency Collective, her organization helps with the heightened need for disaster preparedness in the region. She says the Community Action Agency of Jackson County's Center for Community Resilience is the point of contact for fire survivors in the region. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
President Biden's plan to give millions student debt relief will be challenged before the Supreme Court at the end of February, and the justices will rule at the end of June. Consumer advocates have some advice about what to do in the meantime. Suzanne Potter reports.
Millions of Americans with student loans are anxious to hear if the Supreme Court will uphold President Joe Biden's plan to offer up to $20,000 in student debt relief. Now, financial experts have some tips on what to do while we wait. Conservative groups are challenging the program, claiming it unfairly favors people who went to college and that the president cannot offer debt relief without the consent of Congress. Jalen Herbin with the Center for Responsible Lending says in the interim, borrowers need to stay in constant contact with their loan servicer, which might have changed.
During the beginning of 2022, federal student aid took on new contracts with services. It used to be Navy and Sallie Mae. So you should have been receiving some of those emails. Some of them may have come from Aid Advantage, who took on the Navy contract, Mohila as well.
People can sign up to receive updates from the Department of Education to keep tabs on the status of the program. The administration is not taking any more applications until the case is resolved. The High Court hears opening arguments on February 28th and will rule by June. During COVID, the administration paused payments on federal student loans. Herbin says people who voluntarily made payments during the pause should know they are eligible to get that money back.
But if they just had extra money and they wanted to get ahead of these payments, then they can receive a refund. They just have to write to their servicer and request that refund.
However, if the program is struck down, the entire loan, including the refund, will have to be repaid. In California, more than 2.3 million borrowers applied or were deemed eligible for a refund, and almost 1.5 million were approved before the program was frozen by the court. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
President Biden says he will meet with members of the Congressional Black Caucus about needed policing and justice reforms. With that story and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Our hearts go out to the family, but this has become a maddening deja vu of Black mothers, of Black parents wailing for their children, and a community collectively grieving and mourning.
Representative Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts says it will take great political will to change policing in America and end the incidents of police violence, which led to the death of 29-year-old Tyree Nichols of Memphis. President Biden will meet with members of the Congressional Black Caucus this week to discuss what it says are much-needed national reforms to the justice system. Meanwhile, the parents of Tyree Nichols will reportedly attend President Biden's State of the Union address on February 7th.
When anyone goes to the grocery store this week, you can blame everybody in D.C. that's not willing to live within our means for your interest rates going up and the cost of your eggs and meat going up.
Senator Rick Scott of Florida and members of the Senate Republican Conference say they will not vote for any bill to raise the nation's debt limit unless it's tied to significant budget cuts. The senators say meaningful structural reform in spending is needed to address the nation's $31 trillion debt. Nearly $5.5 billion of COVID-19 aid may have been awarded to small businesses with ineligible Social Security numbers.
There's an urgency to get the money out, and so you may not do the same level of due diligence before writing those checks.
Sean Moulton with the Project on Government Oversight says much of the abuse is connected to the government's Paycheck Protection Program.
Redistricting is like an election in reverse. Usually the voters get to pick the politicians. In redistricting, the politicians get to pick the voters.
Former GOP strategist Tom Hofeller was known as the master of the modern gerrymander, and his impact still resonates today. The Democracy Docket says unresolved legal challenges to redrawn political maps could play a big role in 2024 congressional elections. Litigation is ongoing in 15 states, including New York and Texas, and their combined 64 congressional seats.
When and if this vote comes, it will be a moment of clarity. And I hope many of these Republicans will have conscience.
Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar says she looks forward to a floor vote regarding her reappointment to the House Foreign Affairs Committee. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is leading efforts to unseat Omar based on her previous comments regarding Israel. However, three Republicans now say they will oppose McCarthy's efforts. The House is poised to vote Tuesday on a bill titled the Pandemic is Over Act, though President Biden has announced he will end the twin national emergencies addressing the COVID-19 pandemic on May 11th. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
February 13th is the deadline for the public to weigh in on the EPA's new rules on methane emissions at oil and gas facilities. Methane emissions contribute to ground-level ozone, which can be harmful to the health of children and people who work outdoors. Eric Galatis has more.
The public has until February 13th to weigh in on new rules proposed by the Environmental Protection Agency to reduce methane pollution at oil and gas facilities. Emma Gallofrey-Garcia is a doctoral student at CU Boulder's Environmental Studies program. She says the EPA has an opportunity to build on successful efforts led by states including Colorado to rein in methane emissions, a dangerous air pollutant.
It's a precursor to ozone and smog, causing lung damage, heart damage, greater susceptibility to respiratory infections, and causes and worsens lung disease such as asthma and bronchitis.
Some critics of proposals to limit methane pollution, including those passed in Colorado that require oil and gas operators to find and fix leaks and reduce flaring, have argued that the cost of implementation can be prohibitive. Proponents argue that companies benefit by capturing emissions and bringing more gas to market. Some communities face greater risks than others. Latinos are twice as likely to go to the emergency room for asthma, and Latino children are twice as likely to die from asthma as white children. Garcia says Latinos historically have had no other option but to live in the shadows of refineries and other sources of air pollution, but the goal should be to make all neighborhoods safe for families.
Communities of color, Latinos, have only had access to housing that have been redlined and that are in areas that are more polluted. But it's also that we don't want places like that to exist.
She says industrial methane emissions targeted in the EPA's new rules also come with toxins linked to cancer, damage to immune systems, and developmental problems in children.
Outdoor workers who are disproportionately Latino and children who spend a lot of time outdoors are at higher risk for health problems caused by smog since they spend more time outdoors in polluted air.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in depth. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX, then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be cloudy, with wind gusts up to 4 miles an hour and an overnight low of 25 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy as well, with a high of 47. Today in history, in 2020, the United Kingdom officially leaves the European Union after 47 years as a member state. The quote of the day is from Greek tragedy writer Euripides, who said, quote, One loyal friend is worth 10,000 relatives. The U.S. Justice Department has asked Tesla to provide documents related to its autopilot and full self-driving automobile features. The Austin-based electric vehicle company is already facing multiple investigations by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration for problems with its two driver assist systems. Tesla is concerned any enforcement actions could have adverse impact on its business. Despite their labels, Tesla says on its website that the cars cannot drive themselves. Experts say the full driving system can make mistakes, which even CEO Elon Musk acknowledges. The systems have been under federal investigation since June of 2016, when a driver using autopilot was killed after his Tesla went under a tractor trailer crossing its path in Florida. A separate investigation from August of 2021 is looking into Teslas that were using autopilot when they crashed into emergency vehicles. At least 14 Teslas did so while using the autopilot system. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA, has sent investigators to 35 Tesla crashes in which automated systems are suspected of being used. 19 people have died in those crashes, including two motorcyclists. Full self-driving became an available feature in late 2015. It costs $15,000 to activate the system. In 2015, CEO Elon Musk predicted that the company would have full autonomy in some 3 years. He later said in early 2022 that his cars would be autonomous that year. Auto safety advocates and government investigators have long criticized Tesla's monitoring system, saying that it's inadequate. The Highway and Traffic Safety Administration has documented numerous Tesla crashes where drivers had their hands on the wheel but were still not paying attention. The agency has said that autopilot is being used in areas where its capabilities are limited. They also say that many drivers are not taking action to avoid crashes despite warnings from the vehicle. Tesla said today, quote, "To our knowledge, no government agency in any ongoing investigation has concluded that any wrongdoing occurred," end quote. In pre-market trading, Tesla shares slipped 1.3%. Tribes in Alaska are celebrating an EPA decision to halt a pebble mine in the state. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A coalition of Bristol Bay tribes, community members, Native corporations, and organizations in Alaska is celebrating the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's action to stop the proposed Pebble Copper and Gold Mine project from being built. On Monday, the EPA issued a final determination protecting the salmon-rich Bristol Bay watershed under the Clean Water Act. The EPA determined certain discharges associated with developing the Pebble Mine will have adverse effects on salmon fisheries in the Bristol Bay watershed. The tribes, Bristol Bay residents, commercial and sport fishers, environmental groups, and others have long fought for the protection of fish, water, and people in the region. In 2010, Bristol Bay tribes first formally petitioned the EPA to protect the pristine watershed under the Clean Water Act. The tribes of Bristol Bay Native Association, the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, and the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation released statements Tuesday calling the moment historic and celebrating the protection of their lands, water, and cultures. Developers, the Pebble Limited Partnership, in a statement said, "The preemptive action against Pebble is not supported legally, technically, or environmentally, and they'll likely take legal action." Monday's decision follows years of litigation and a 2020 key Pebble Mine permit denial by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. A joint resolution to recognize the history and trauma of Indian boarding schools and asking for a day of remembrance was recently heard in the Montana legislature. Montana Public Radio's Ellis Julin reports.
Democratic Senator Susan Weber from Browning is carrying the resolution, which asks the 68th legislature to recognize the trauma inflicted by removing American Indian children from their families and sending them to boarding schools. Senator Weber is a member of the Blackfeet Nation and shared her firsthand experience as a survivor of these schools, having attended the Cutbank boarding school until junior high.
I wanted to bring this bill because my generation is the last generation that had to go to boarding school. We had to go to boarding school. Now, I'm not 150 years old. This was still going on in the 60s.
The resolution also asks the U.S. government to create a National Day of Remembrance for the children that died in boarding schools. The U.S. Department of the Interior published a report last year as part of an ongoing investigation into the country's past assimilation policies. That report found 408 boarding schools across 37 states, including 18 sites in Montana. More than a dozen people gave testimony in support of the resolution in its first committee hearing. There were no opponents. The Senate Education and Cultural Resources Committee did not immediately take action on the bill. For National Native News, I'm Ellis Julin.
The Confederated Tribes of Umatilla Indian Reservation Board of Trustees has legalized hemp and marijuana on the reservation. On Monday, the Board of Trustees voted to amend the criminal code to legalize the possession of marijuana on the reservation in Oregon. The change goes into effect immediately for people 21 years and older to consume and possess marijuana. Tribal laws will be similar to state laws, but any business on the reservation related to marijuana or hemp will be addressed in future codes and regulations. According to the Board of Trustees, the alignment of laws will help the tribe have the option of compacting with the state for any future business in the industry if the tribe chooses to do so. And in New York, the St. Regis Mohawk Tribal Council has adopted a cannabis consumption lounges amendment. The tribal clerk notified tribal membership on Monday that no written comments were received on the amendment, which was signed by the tribal council last week. The membership was given 30 days to comment on the cannabis ordinance. A consultation session was also held earlier in January. The tribe's cannabis control board is now authorized to issue consumption lounge licenses. Lounges may only sell cannabis products, and other approved items to people 21 and older. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The proposed merger between the grocery giants Albertsons and Kroger is before the Federal Trade Commission for approval. Food banks say it'll impact their operations and could further shrink the abilities of rural households to access fresh foods. Nadia Ramlagan has more in Kentucky.
Kentucky food banks say the proposed merger of Kroger and Albertsons, currently under review by the Federal Trade Commission, could trigger an increased demand for services at a time when inflation, gas prices, and the end of pandemic era supports are squeezing household budgets. President and CEO of Dare to Care Food Bank, Vincent James, says another major grocer, Walmart is the nation's largest, could force more farmers out of the market and raise consumer prices, which send more folks to their local food bank.
All of these things have created this sort of perfect storm for folks that were caught in the middle, where they are actually on that benefits cliff where they make too much to get SNAP benefits, but then not making enough to purchase food.
In a news release, Kroger says its acquisition of the Idaho-based chain will expand customer reach and improve access to affordable food to approximately 85 million households. The FTC is expected to make a decision on the sale sometime next year. James adds that a merger could impact both companies' levels of community engagement, noting that retailers are a major player in the food distribution ecosystem.
Whether through programming or providing food, I think Kroger is really uniquely positioned to make a huge impact by continuing to support food banks in more innovative ways and equitable ways.
Rural Americans increasingly lack an affordable and nearby store to buy fresh foods. Between 1994 and 2019, the overall number of grocery operations nationwide declined by 30%, according to Food and Water Watch. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Kentucky News Connection.
More missile and nuclear weapon tests have happened in North Korea. It's a threatening situation and one that now includes the possibility that South Korea itself could go nuclear. Now we go to a global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Let's talk about the new nuclear danger on the Korean Peninsula. Kim Jong-un wants attention, and when he doesn't get it, North Korea takes provocative actions to ensure a U.S. and South Korean response. His latest moves include a major increase in missile launches, double the number in 2022 compared with 2021. Another ICBM test, a looming seventh nuclear weapon test, and announcement of a significant expansion of the North's nuclear weapon arsenal. North Korea also sent drones into South Korean territory, embarrassing the South Korean Air Force, which had initially failed to detect them. The U.S. and South Korean militaries have responded in the usual way, with equally tension-raising steps that have included joint exercises involving the latest bombers and fighter jets. Kim Jong-un's influential sister, Kim Yo-jong, issued a strong condemnation of the U.S. and South Korean actions, as well as of U.S. efforts in the U.N. that led 14 countries to agree on the threat posed by North Korea's advanced weapons development. Kim Yo-jong's statement said, quote, "The U.S. should be mindful that no matter how desperately it may seek to disarm North Korea, it can never deprive North Korea of its right to self-defense, and that the more hell-bent it gets on the anti-North Korea acts, it will face a more fatal security crisis." Years of UN-authorized sanctions on the North for its repeated violations of bans on ballistic missile tests have done little to prevent them. As in the past, Russia and China are standing together with North Korea, most recently in rejecting the U.S. attempt to gain Security Council sanctioning of North Korea's ICBM test. Beijing and Moscow agree with North Korean leaders that its missile tests are defensive responses to U.S.-South Korea missile drills. What makes the current threatening situation more concerning than usual is South Korea's reaction, which has been to bring into public discussion the possibility that it would go nuclear. Over many years, the U.S. has sought to ensure that that does not happen, even in the face of the North's expanding nuclear and missile arsenal. Now, however, the South's new president, Yoon Suk-yeol, has warned that Pyongyang's continued nuclear weapons development may require that, quote, "our country will introduce tactical nuclear weapons or build them on our own." He said South Korea could do so pretty quickly, given our scientific and technological capabilities. Little doubt about that. South Korea has a highly advanced civilian nuclear energy program that could produce enough fuel for bombs in perhaps a few years. But building a credible nuclear deterrent would require an extraordinary investment with deleterious consequences for South Korea's economy and society. What is the likely U.S. response to the South Korean president's suggestions? You can bet the U.S. will do everything possible, even threats to withdraw protection from South Korea to prevent it from going nuclear and thereby dramatically increasing the risk of war on the peninsula. Most likely, the Biden administration will reassure South Korea of its firm support and point to Japan's new strategic thinking that portends a strengthening of trilateral security relations. Washington is also certain to firmly reject Yoon's mention of again stationing U.S. nuclear weapons in South Korea. That move would reverse President George H.W. Bush's withdrawal of those weapons in the early 1990s when both Koreas reached a denuclearization agreement. One can easily imagine the profoundly negative reaction U.S. nukes in South Korea would receive in China and North Korea. Actually, there's no need for changes in the U.S. or South Korean force posture. Their overwhelming conventional capabilities deter North Korea from use of nuclear weapons. The greatest cost arising from Kim Jong-un's latest nuclear decisions is to the North Korean people, who are again in the midst of a food crisis. Preventing diversion to the North Korean military of desperately needed food and medical support intended for ordinary North Koreans remains as problematic as ever. As I've written many times, U.S. policy on North Korea needs to move on from tit-for-tat confrontation to engagement for the sake of both human and strategic security. Kim Jong-un's nuclear policies draw attention to the real peril on the peninsula, not the danger of imminent attack, but war by miscalculation and miscommunication. One element of engagement should be an emphasis on sanctions removal, step by step with a North Korean moratorium, internationally certified on further missile and nuclear weapon testing. Another element should be a shift in U.S. and South Korean objectives, as two writers suggest, from denuclearization of the North to stopping its export of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons technology and weapons design. Denuclearization is an increasingly unachievable goal, given the exceptional investment Kim Jong-un has made in nuclear weapons. If acknowledgement of North Korea as a nuclear weapon state and reduced sanctions are the price for a moratorium and non-proliferation, it's a price worth paying to prevent another Korean War. I'm Mel Gertog for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 31st, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, tips, and curiosities at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Mel Gertov and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Eric Galatis, Antonio Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, and Catherine Carley. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News, my name is Sam. This is Totality of Circumstances, a monthly show focused on the ongoing efforts to create a new police oversight system in Portland. For the past several months, my co-host Jasmine and I have been focusing on the police account.